in ground, speaking in ground in Yemen, on ground, Ansarullah or the government of Sana'a are, they're expanding, and they will not, you know, compromise on any deals. So that will definitely show that Saudi Arabia and U.S. lost this war. That's the first point, I think, which is very important. This matter is very important, especially for Saudi Arabia, because MBS, for him to become the next king, he has to prove himself to be a strong man internally, whether the royal family or inside Saudi Arabia. So for him to lose this war, it's really threatening for him to be, it really threatens him to become the next king. The second point is that U.S. is you know, there is no reason for U.S. to push for a political resolution here. Their arms industry is booming. They're making billions and billions in terms of economic benefits, and they're not held accountable by the international community because Saudi Arabia and UAE are really in the you know, in the picture of this war. So for them, I don't see why they would really want a political resolution to take place in Yemen.
Well, Frank Imsbach, 1 year anniversary of President Biden declaring that the war needs to end, the offensive support, as he called it, but that the war needs to end was what this 1 year anniversary Friday marked. You had recently Democrats asking Joe Biden that he needs to clarify U.S. role in the Yemen conflict, and offer more than just vague declarations. I'm looking at the $650 million sale to Saudi Arabia, and then you're looking at this particular sale that has just happened. I don't see anything vague about the U.S. stance at this point, which means, as we have said, military sales. Where did Joe Biden sway from that? Because it looked like he was sincere.
Well, I think he swayed from it when they're, according to the newspapers, that the Houthis were able to successfully launch missiles and attack the rear of the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates. There's some American troops there, so that's an excuse to always side with the wrong side, I suppose. And I think that, you know, internally, our meaning the United States, sees its interests as the Saudi interests here. And it certainly sees the arms sales that way. So given those circumstances, we would side with the people with the cash. And the people with the cash are the Emirates and the Saudis, certainly not the Houthis, right? And so, you know, there is a pressure to do that. And that's why I mean that the sales and things like that outweigh what would really be serious policy considerations about how to bring stability to the Middle East. Let's be serious here. We've invaded. We invaded Iraq on totally what everybody admits now is craziness, right? It just simply didn't happen. There were no weapons of mass destruction. But only because we have a completely militarized policy driven in part by a military-industrial complex. I mean, this is old hat in a certain sense, but you're right. There is not a political force in this country that's capable of taking on that complex.
Okay, this is where it gets confusing, Hamza Karim. You have the news.
Yeah, there'd be something, but we do not see that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were done there. I do apologize for that. Hamza Karim, this is where it gets confusing. When you take a look at the news recently, it keeps repeating one particular stance, and that is there's a new front that has now been opened on the war in Yemen. The Yemeni army has attacked the UAE deep in its territory. And it keeps repeating itself, and then you have other news attached to it that have followed, like developments regarding the U.S. being also involved, where it stepped in. It's shot down a couple of these, drones using the missile defense system, as they call it. Why is it that they call that a new front, but they don't come out and call the over 300,000 that perhaps have been killed or more and keep getting killed as that being a new front? Because those civilian casualties are so much more.
Yeah,
who are you at?
Again, this is...
Hamza Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, this is, again, back... It highly depends. These matters really are related to U.S. interests in the region. The U.S. administration, not only this administration, like if you think about it, since the war started in Yemen, there have been three different administrations that came into power in the U.S. It started with the Obama administration, Trump administration, and now Biden's administration. And throughout the three administrations, a lot of foreign policies have changed for the U.S. But one thing that is really in common between these three administrations is the war in Yemen. None of these administrations really wanted to stop this war, because eventually U.S. really looks at these wars and assess them based on their interests. Attacking UAE, attacking Saudi Arabia really hurts U.S. interests in the region. But killing civilians in Yemen really doesn't mean anything to U.S. So, yeah, again, U.S. is, okay. is you know, based on this, U.S. is you know, moving forward.
Sure. That's exactly a good lead into my question, Frank Emspach, to you. The U.S. is moving forward. It's actually becoming more prominent. I mentioned about how it thwarted, as it said, two of the missiles that were shot from the Yemeni army. It is also now becoming more visible by sending fighter jets, warships to the UAE. We understand, obviously, that the U.S. does have a base in the UAE, but you have the guided missile destroyer USS Cole to partner with the UAE Navy. Why is the U.S., or is the U.S. becoming more physically present in this war, and why did it decide to do to take that step?
I think that we're seeing in part the results of Afghanistan here, where the United States wants to make it clear that we're not going to be driven out of any place in the Middle East, and that we are still the people to have to go to for arms and equipment, and we're going to do that. I mean, let's be serious here. We are, you know, sort of tied at the hip with the Saudis. Here you have, if we go back three or four administrations to 9/11, right? The people who attacked the United States were all Saudis, and we attacked Afghanistan. You know, so unless we, you know, that was, you would think that we might have some issues with the Saudis or with the murder of that journalist, right? But that's not the case, and so we are wedded to the Saudi regime, which means we're wedded to having MBS become the king and that he be successful. And in order to do that, he's got to win this war, as far as they're concerned. And that's it. And that is that's what's driving this, I think. And the immediacy, in a certain sense, was the precipitous withdrawal in Afghanistan. There was no reason to do that. You could have worked out an arrangement with the Taliban to have an orderly withdrawal. That's what they were trying to do. And bang, you know, and incidentally, by starving them to death, as we're trying to do also, that is a problem for us. It doesn't look good. So we might as well go ahead and do the military option, because that's really where the United States administration, all of them, have been comfortable.
Trying to understand how that is, Hamza Karim, when our guest Frank Emspach says that the U.S. is tied to the hips with the U.S., walk us through this. You know, you have Saudi Arabia, in which the Crown Prince is, even by CIA standards, responsible for the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. You have the 9/11 incidents, where you have so many of them who were involved, Saudi citizens. And yet, when it comes to just a thing about oil production, the Saudis won't even help the U.S. out there. How is it that the U.S. is so bound with Saudi Arabia? Why?
I think Trump really answered this question very well when he was a president, and he said that when he was asked in a press conference why U.S. doesn't stop supporting Saudi Arabia, he said in a very concise and accurate statement, he said if we stop supporting Saudi Arabia, it means that there will be no Israel anymore. Today, it's very obvious that Saudi Arabia and UAE and Israel, there is an alliance between them. All these countries think that their security, the security of Saudi Arabia and UAE, is really part of the security of Israel. And U.S. will never leave Israel alone, in the region, especially with rising powers in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq. This is, I think, it's taking more of an a regional perspective here rather than one country problem.
While Hamza Karim was speaking there, Frank Emsbach, I was thinking about how the U.S. is involved in this standoff with Russia over Ukraine. You have the situation of the U.S. involved in a crisis in the South China Sea with China. You have the U.S. involved in what we're looking at here in the war in Yemen, not to mention other military engagements. It almost takes the, one's breath away to think about the military engagements. Isn't the U.S. Kind of thin or going thin on all these?
Well, I don't know if it's going thin, but what's happening is that you are having a narrowing of the discussions here, and you also have a very weak government in the sense that you have a good portion of the population for the first time, a third, who's questioning the very legitimacy of the government. And so one response that has been, you know, tried and true for many, many governments in many, many years is a military option, where you have a situation where there's crises and you have to rally behind the commander in chief. I don't think that can be completely dismissed here. But in terms of the Saudi issue, I think the United States has seen Saudi Arabia as the bastion of a politics, an anti-people politics, a politics which is extremely conservative, a politics which favors a certain type of capitalism. And that's it. That's the driver in terms of policy. And I don't think you're going to see much change there. To the extent that the Houthis or that people in Iraq or the people in Syria or the whole Arab Spring challenged those policies, those ideas, that organization of society, the United States was going to line up with Saudi Arabia and did and helped support, finance and whatnot, all kinds of stuff since the Arab Spring to move the politics back to a more conservative anti-people position, as we did in Egypt.
Final question to you, Hamza Karim. What is your reading into the war games that were held in which Saudi Arabia and Israel were involved with the U.S. and some other, I guess, 9,000 people from 60 regional navies, as it said? What is your reading into having that war game at this point? Especially the fact that you have Saudi Arabia, along with Israel, participate in it with the U.S.
See, the fact that this is happening in the Red Sea really, shows us that Israel is really worried about, having the Red Sea under the control of Ansarullah or the government on Sana'a. Controlling the Red Sea means choking Israel, because if you control the Red Sea, it means that Israel doesn't have access to water, or most of the ships that are going from Israel and from around the world to Israel could be under danger.
Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Hamza Karim, many thanks. Yemeni activist and political commentator. Frank Emsbach from Madison, thank you. Emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikava Tahwai. And the entire team is goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from every single corner of the world, wherever you are, I hope you're doing well and everything is fine with you. This is IRIB English Radio, and today I have the privilege to be your host. I am Asma, and with us, we have two dear friends and guests in the studio. Welcome, brothers. Would you please introduce yourself to us?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brother Habib at your service, representing California.
So, welcome.
My name is Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, and I am from the land down under.
Okay, that's very good. Welcome to the program. So pleased to have you here. Oh, well, we're all buckled up for you to take us back to reality. Today we're going to talk about revolutions, and we want to see if it is an essential part of human beings' way of thinking. I mean, what if there was no revolution in the world?
Is it possible even to think about that? Can there be a society, people living in a community, and there could be no such thing? Of course, with the corrupt.
Yes, and having brain and that intellectual faculty, then how it comes?
I don't think that it's possible, especially with the diverse communities and societies, especially when, let's talk about the Arab tribes, when they come together, for example, and, problems are going to appear. If there has to be one ruler, why that ruler? Who put that ruler? And it really just goes back to the fact of the idea of the concept of a true caliph by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes, that's very true. What's your idea?
How can I talk about revolution without making it political?
It's not possible.
It's not possible.
It's not
right?
possible because it has to, it's political.
You
the
mean
term is political.
Having evolutions without
now,
having...
revolution, we're talking about evolution. Human beings could evolve, yes.
But. So you're trying to say that the guy becomes a good guy, right? He's like an oppressor and trying ruler, then he becomes a good guy?
Evolved into a good guy,
therefore the society evolves?
No, but I think the concept of revolution, it's just like, what causes a revolution?
Exactly. That's
do we
what,
need it?
Was,
I don't think we need a revolution. Unless
you, we don't need a revolution?
Unless there's a cause for it.
Of course. There's always going to be a cause.
So why
do people go
for revolution?
Why? Obviously to seek justice. Well, it depends on the aim of the revolution because sometimes people, if you look at history, you've seen a lot of people who were bad who revolted against good leaders, right? Because they just didn't like them. So I don't think it's very easy to pinpoint why people want to revolt because sometimes, like I said, you can have an oppressed system. Look at Iran, for example. And the Shah was a bad person, and people revolted against him because they wanted a just system. Sayyid Khomeini came, gave him a system.
So they want to change. There is also another revolution, which is the inner sort of revolution.
You got all mystic. That inner revolution, that's evolution.
It could be a revolution, too. Yeah, after the revolution... evolution comes.
Yeah.
Right? After the revolution, evolution comes.
Yeah, because sometimes like when you're sleeping and you're slumber for too long, like the Quran calls it in ghafla, in the mode of ghafla. Mm.
And what is ghafla? Can you please
explain? Ghafla just being unaware. So you're just moving with life and just consuming just like
unfearful of Allah. That's what
it, like you just eat and sleep.
Being
and,
unaware.
Unaware, completely unaware of life and you just don't care about anything. You're just eating and sleeping and just enjoying yourself. And you're completely missed the boat or you're going in a different direction against the one that Allah has drawn for you. And at a certain point, you wake up and you realize like, okay, I've done so many wrong. I've headed the wrong way. And then you've seen that you've done so much wrong and now you have so many bad habits. And these bad habits, they're not going to die by themselves. They need you to revolt against them. Make
so
this revolution
takes,
change within yourself.
So it has many steps, you mean? Personal revolution has many steps.
Obviously, everything has a step.
The sunrise and sunset
has steps. Everything in life has a step. But I'm saying this inner revolution that you were talking about, I'm saying is it because you have so many bad habits and so many bad things, you need to change so you revolt against yourself and you
so
deprive
yourself. So at first,
yourself.
I have to be aware of them. At first,
you have to wake up.
Yes, I have to wake up.
You have to wake up first. Like the poetry, he says, if the nation want to revolt, first they have to wake up and break the chains. Otherwise,
yes.
You're not going to revolt. Right?
That's very true.
So waking up, obviously, is the first. Even with Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his revolution, people were asleep. He wanted to wake them up.
He wanted to wake them up. So just imagine as a person who's listening to you, I have some bad habits and I have came to the conclusion that, okay, I have to wake up. What steps do I have to take?
It depends on every person's situation. I've heard this from the student, direct student from Sheikh Al-Bahjat, actually. He stated that it took me 40 years to become a good teacher in Hausa, right? Or in that person that I am right now.
Of course, Ayatollah Behjet was one of the greatest scholars in
Qom. This idea is very beautiful. And in hada din lamatin, this religion is very
strong.
It's very tight-gripped. And therefore, you have to take it step by step. You're not going to wake up one day and all of a sudden become Waliullah Al-A'zam. Take it step by step, especially for the, aftermaths of it,
Talk about the steps you mentioned.
Like how my brother stated, the first thing is to actually wake up.
Wake up.
And we see that a lot in the sayings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
Yes.
And that is that they always remind us of death. The Quran always reminds us of the Day of Judgment. We always see that fact, that factor in it. That's always trying to, you know, wake up. You're not going to live forever. Yeah. You have this. You have to do this. You have to do that. When you move these chains, like how my brother beautifully put it, you go into a second step, and that is gaining knowledge.
Exactly.
And that's very important. Of course, other mystics will put it in this way.
Isn't that waking up very easy?
Waking up is actually easy. It's in our innate. It's in our fitrah. It's in our power. All you have to do is just look and istabir, which is pretty much to take al-ibra.
I disagree.
You believe it's difficult to wake up?
I do believe so, too.
It depends, especially if you're talking about like 50 years back, 60 years back, maybe. In our modern day, waking up is the hardest thing.
Because bad things also seem to be good.
No, because you are now consumed by so many things.
By material world?
Yeah. That you can't
even think. All it takes is just one loss of family member.
They're trying to keep you asleep.
I don't know.
I mean...
Look, just don't look at the world.
I understand where you are living.
There's a difference between wanting to wake up and waking up itself. Waking up itself is not that difficult. Wanting to wake up, I think that's what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is difficult. When you cling on to something like Pharaoh did, you cling on. It's very hard to leave.
No, we need to make it clear.
What is exactly waking up? We need to make it clear. How is it? Wake up. What do we exactly mean?
That revolution happening in your soul, in your spirit. When you want to move forward in your life and you want to run towards your purpose of life, true waking up is easy, but falling back to sleep again is also easy. That's also something to consider.
Yes, and it's easier. If you speak about it from a psychological perspective, right? Waking up in the way that you just made it, I don't think it's an instant thing. You require a reminder. There has to be a trigger point. That makes you go back. I'm not just sitting like playing and having fun. Like, oh, you know what? Death. Let me go back. So, for example, something triggers something for those people. Like, for example, who were Christians and became Muslim. Something triggered in their lives and that put them in the path of religion. And then they kept searching until they found Islam. For example, they said the stories
they were
that
woke.
Been hearing. So there has to be a trigger point.
There must be something happening in their life.
Something has to trigger
the need that. For.
That's
that.
Why I'm saying the second step is knowledge. That's what I'm saying, the second step is knowledge. The first step is like waking up. And that's the problem.
Waking up requires you to feel wanting to wake up. Wanting to wake up requires a trigger.
Okay, brothers, I think this is exactly where we're going to have a break. Don't go anywhere. Stick to us. We're coming back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Okay, welcome back to your own program, Back to Reality. We were talking about revolutions, which has two different points, inner revolution and outer revolution. The inner revolution is going to be pretty much of difficult, and it is very much tricky because the waking up is going to take some time. The need for that waking up must come at first, and then you're going to feel that you need some change in your life. Brother Habib and Brother Abdullah, we are going back to our discussion.
Said Abdullah rushed to a point where he believed that wanting to wake up needs a trigger point. And after you're awake, you have this intention, and this intention is right away. After that, you need to gain knowledge. After gaining knowledge, you act upon your knowledge. Because in the sayings of Ahlul Bayt, the true knowledge is the one that's acted upon. And when you act upon your knowledge, that's the satisfaction of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's the purpose of your life that you want to reach. And, you know, some other mystics might claim that, first of all, you must, you know, tahalli wa takhalli, or, you know, these kinds of terminologies.
What those words mean?
Pretty much means that the first thing is to restrain from the obligated things, and then to do the obligated thing, to restrain from the prohibited actions, then to do the obligated actions, then to also do the recommended actions. But in the sayings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam, me personally, I have not found this kind of, you know, idea and concept. I've seen the opposite. I've seen that restraining al-wara is something, yes, that what all must do, al-wara, or restraining from prohibited actions. Obligations is an obligation. There are some actions that are recommended that one must do.
So at first, there was a trigger, then we woke up, and now we're taking the steps into...
to knowledge and then acting upon your knowledge.
Yes. So that's and now there comes this thing that you already talked about it. Can we keep it like the way it happened? I mean, now the revolution happened and my eyes are wide open. But like the outer revolutions, you know, after some years, everything changed and I am back to the same me. What can we do to keep it the way it has changed?
That's the beauty with the connection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The doors of tawbah, the doors of repentance are open. And it's very beautifully put in Dua Abi Hamza al-Thamali. I really recommend anyone who goes, enters into the nights of Layal al-Qadr to not waste their time on doing actions that have no source to it from the words of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasallam, but rather to go and recite Dua Abi Hamza al-Thamali. And in it, Mali, that part, Mali kullama qultu qad sulihat sarirati. Every time I say that I have become a good person, I have woken up, I am becoming a good person.
Something happens.
Some disaster happens and makes me slip and I fall back down. لَعَلَّكَ عَنْ بَابِكَ طَرَدْتَنِي. Maybe you have kicked me out of your door. Then he continues with that connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And it's waking up you, it's not waking up your sense of you wanting to connect with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So after the revolution, we have to be connected with God.
We remain connected with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And to always believe and put this in your mind that you always have the chance to connect with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you sinned and left and fell asleep 1,000, 1 billion times, I don't know, countless times, if you fall into that sleep, there's still that chance of you connecting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But hasten to it. Don't take your time with it.
Yes, and of course, there's no revolution without a breakage. You should break yourself and then come to the conclusion.
I do agree. I do agree to some extent. Because sometimes, even when we wake up, a lot of people, like she said, that their sister, that they fall back into sleep. And when they fall heavy, right? Because sometimes it's Shaitan himself, he lets you change, he lets you wake up, and he lets you grow. And once you grow, he breaks you down to an extent that you can't get up anymore. So one of the ulama, he says, the Shaitan, he allows the tree to grow older, and once you cut an older tree, it will not grow anymore.
Cuts it from the root.
That's it, it's not going to grow anymore. So you cut it, and even from the middle, it will not grow anymore. But if it's a small tree and you unplug it, will grow back again because it's tiny, right? So it has the potential to grow. But once you fall, that's it, you're gone. So the dangers of waking up and not maintaining your state of awareness could be devastating.
A very nice point. You put it very beautifully. Thank you, dear guests. This was all we talked about revolution. The first step to revolution, the inner revolution that we talked about, was to wake up, to know that you're in need of a change. You have to change into a better person. And then you have to be linked and connected to God. That's the only way to keep it alive. Thank you for listening to us. Until another session, I leave you to the protection of God.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
We congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt,
Indian-administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A number of road haulage associations warned on Wednesday that lorry drivers won't take it anymore and are ready to go on the warpath as petrol, diesel and methane prices continue to surge dramatically in Italy. Higher fuel prices and household energy bills have further swelled living costs for people in Italy, with lorry drivers being among the hardest hit. Fuel prices overall in Italy are now at the highest since 2012. Petrol has gone up in price by almost 20% over the past 12 months, meaning it now costs an average over 9,000 euros more per month for a lorry driver to fill up.
We have sent the government an alert about the rising level of dissatisfaction among lorry drivers as they simply can no longer cover the costs. Drivers are now holding meetings autonomously in several Italian cities, and protests will be staged soon. They are demanding lower gas prices as well as reductions in taxes and tolls.
Lorry driving is the leading form of freight transportation in Italy, as 85% of all goods are shipped by road in the country. That's compared to a European average of about 70%. However, over the past years, Italian lorry drivers have seen their workload significantly decreasing as Eastern European haulers have surged into the Italian market.
As a result of lower labour costs, a growing number of Eastern European haulers have entered the Italian commercial transport system, thus leaving Italian lorry drivers fewer opportunities. Another reason behind this progressive reduction in competitiveness is the high excise duties we pay for fuel in Italy.
Italian lorry drivers have staged protests on several occasions over the past years, blockading major ports, borders and the main routes into Italy's cities. Road haulage associations are slated to meet with the government on February 17 in a final attempt to ease the simmering tensions. Max Civili, Rome.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us, you know, it boosts our morale and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable. It's possible since it has been realized elsewhere. You know, the success of the revolution was, a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian Revolution is a revolution that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socioeconomic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and all the like, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have travelled to the United States, Ukraine and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe, and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, EU citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies. So this is really frightening to me personally. And I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody just spend less money on army and more money on compensation kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting one of the major oil shows in the country. The Ahwaz Oil Exhibition brought together 210 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are in the list of U.S. sanctions.
One of our major products is the two-phase flow pump, which is a vital piece in the oil exploration process. We used to be dependent on foreign supply of this equipment, and due to the sanctions, it was really hard to access it. So we decided to rely on our domestic expertise, and we now build two-phase pumps locally. We also specialize in the production and execution of all kinds of offshore oil rigs from A to Z.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But Washington's oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build this needed machinery, including drilling bits. And the result is beyond expectation.
Because of the sanctions, the oil industrial companies... could not, you know, import these very important drilling rigs. So in these years, we made more than 300 drilling bits and PDC bits, and we made it, we manufactured it domestically. And we think that we can continue, manufacturing all of the needs of Iran.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 deal and the reimposition of sanctions the same year. Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs, down from 2.5 million. This prompted the country to rebuild its oil sector using its domestic know-how, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
Less than a century ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector. Experts here say this would be another turning point in the oil industry, since it would shield the country's crude from the blows of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Ahwaz.
New communications director Guto Harry walking into the prime minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the prime minister's shakeup at number 10.
is not actually driven by Boris. It's being driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid-stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned four of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour, asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
And this is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as Prime Minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Saipur is up, London.
Advocates and families of Palestinian prisoners have protested at the Red Cross office in the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates languishing inside Israeli jails. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are suffering from medical negligence.
Israel is practicing systematic medical negligence against Palestinian prisoners. Currently, more than 700 prisoners are suffering from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical care. Palestinian prisoners also must not be treated inside military hospitals.
Hundreds of Palestinians are also being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Islamic Jihad movement slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
As we stand here, we affirm our support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. They have been refusing to attend courts for 38 days now, because administrative detention is illegal and is a crime against Palestinians.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are prisoners of war, and they must be treated according to international law and norms. Because we are under occupation, Palestinian prisoners need international protection, and Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and inhumane detention conditions.
Latest figures by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran and Kashmir have a long history of cultural, linguistic and ethnic ties dating back to pre-Islamic period. The arrival of great Iranian religious missionaries in Kashmir, particularly in the 14th and 15th century, cemented this bond further. The overwhelming Iranian influence in Kashmir earned the Himalayan region the sobriquet of Iran-e-Saghir, or Little Iran. In February 1979, following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Kashmir was among the first to wholeheartedly embrace it. They rejoiced at Iran's liberation from the clutches of the US-backed Pahlavi regime.
I remember when the news of triumph of Islamic Revolution reached here, people of all shades took to the streets in jubilation. Rallies and gatherings were held. Soon after the victory of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir, followed by the other prominent revolutionary figures like Mehdavi Ghani and Golzadeh Ghafouri. The bond between Iran and Kashmir has only grown stronger over the years.
People were very minutely and very carefully watching the Iran revolution at that time. And for a few reasons, Kashmir has been, you know, historically connected with Iran and Central Asia. There was a propagation of Islam here and a lot of people converting to the faith of Islam as a result of Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani. Hamdani brought economic pursuits like, say, binding industry, paper and binding industry at that time, 550 years back. And along with traditional handicrafts, which were, you know, flourishing at that time in Iran, he brought certain artisans, certain craftsmen, skilled people, and they came along with the propagation of faith.
Political observers and academics in this Muslim-majority region believe the Islamic Revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism struck a chord with people in Kashmir. They derived inspiration from it in their quest for freedom, justice and equality.
People of Kashmir saw it positively. They cooperated with it because there was already a prevailing atmosphere of Muslim unity in Kashmir those days. They joined the gatherings which were celebrated in connection with the celebration of Islamic Revolution and as a message for Islamic unity and the upliftment of the downtrodden peoples of the world.
As the world marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, people here in Kashmir take immense pride in being the advocates of this great movement that has championed the cause of Islamic revival and resistance against the arrogant powers of the world. Sayyid Ali Safid, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iranians celebrate the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution that transformed their country from a U.S. ally to a bitter opponent. Yemenis are still facing a deadly U.S.-backed war. This has urged Yemeni politicians to try to learn more about the Islamic Revolution and its stance against U.S. hegemony.
The region was about to fall prey to the American Zionist project, and the Arab regimes would have given up on the Palestinian cause, resulting in the further oppression of the Palestinians and the deterioration of the Arabs' dream of liberation from American hegemony. The Islamic Revolution turned Iran into the first country to be freed from U.S. dependence. It created a psychological balance among the people. As for the Arab puppet regimes, they feared the danger of the people and delayed their normalization with the Zionists. Today, Muslims are aware of U.S. dominating policies and find liberation necessary.
Yemeni politicians and scholars say the Islamic Revolution keeps on inspiring Yemeni people to stand against the U.S. and its supported forces in the region, just as they did on their September 21st revolution 8 years ago.
I still remember the outbreak of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. I was studying in secondary school and Arab people were constantly talking about it. We even wore t-shirts with the image of Imam Khomeini. But given the importance of this revolution, many Arab dictators started to ban the clothes that had the image of Imam Khomeini on them. And this is one of the first memories that they have of the Islamic Revolution. The Yemeni people have learned a lot from the Islamic Revolution in Iran. It encouraged them to stand against the colonial policies in their own country. And this also sparked their revolution of September 21st, 2014.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has always been a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause and has marked the International Quds Day, and now it is also standing beside the people of Yemen in the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war against them.
Observers say all the free people of the world must look up to the Islamic Revolution of Iran and follow in the footsteps of its leaders in order to stand against the U.S. hegemony. They say the Islamic Revolution will remain a source of pride for all Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
While Iran is marking the anniversary of its 1979 revolution, which overthrew a U.S.-backed regime, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank hail it as the most successful revolution in the contemporary era. I met the former speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, Dr. Hassan Khreshi. He praised the Iranian revolution as a source of inspiration in the region and beyond. After the 1979 revolution, Iran started supporting the Palestinians. It all began after Iranians took over the Israeli embassy in Tehran and handed it over to the Palestine Liberation Organization. As part of its effort to inspire the oppressed people, Iran aided emerging Palestinian resistance groups, notably the movements of Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Both the Palestinian factions sent their representatives to Tehran, while Iran's support for both groups continue until today. Iran's Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments. To Palestinians, the revolution anniversary is reminiscent of their struggle for independence and resistance against the Israeli atrocities. Iran's Islamic Revolution is viewed today as a potent, unstoppable force in the region and beyond. An example in this regard is the heroic struggles of the Palestinian people against Israel. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
U.S. police violence targeting black people has once again brought Americans to the streets in the northern city of Minneapolis, which is still reeling from the police murder of George Floyd, a black man, in 2020. This time, the victim is Amir Locke, a 22-year-old African-American who was killed when police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters rallied in the city, calling for the arrest of officers involved in the shooting and an end to discriminatory law enforcement tactics. Similar protests were held in New York City. The officers were carrying out a no-knock search warrant on the apartment. The city's mayor has now announced a suspension of no-knock warrants that have been at the center of heated debates over rising police violence. Back in 2020, the city restricted the use of such unannounced raids as part of a series of reforms that were introduced following mass anti-racism protests.
They barge in before they ever identify themselves, and they give Amir no time to save his own life. And that's something that we don't see white citizens encounter. And the fact that it's happening in Minneapolis again is beyond tragic, it's abhorrent.
Locke's parents say their son was a beloved member of his community and a law-abiding citizen.
I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Locke's death has reopened the wounds caused by the murder of Floyd and a dozen of other recent victims. Official figures show that black men are three times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. But police bullets, batons, or knees are not the only concerns to African Americans. The deep-rooted anti-black racism also shows itself in inadequate access to health care, food, housing, and jobs. In 2020, the injustices long felt by African Americans triggered a nationwide protest movement challenging police brutality and bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. And that movement transformed into a global campaign to fight racism and build a world free of discrimination and supremacist ideologies.
Wish to congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
in the limelight.
Today, the malign behavior of the U.S. is firmly countered by the people of West Asia and throughout the world, as is evident in Latin America and other places. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kahan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Hurtling Headlong into Self-Destruction. Stay tuned for more. It is an undeniable fact that the U.S. is hurtling headlong into disaster through its criminal policies against the rest of the world on the assumption that it will hold the entire planet as hostage to its devilish desires. It definitely cannot. Sooner than later, the state terrorism of Washington is bound to boomerang with a terrible result that, God willing, will see the end of history's most evil empire. When the leader of the Islamic Revolution points out that the former and the current presidents of the U.S. have joined hands to ruin whatever is left of their country's reputation, it is a reality. Thanks to the guidelines of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Iran and its officials stand steadfast against the intricate plots of the U.S. that cover not just media and diplomatic aggression, but spread into the spheres of economy, politics, security, and culture in the vain hope of deceiving the Islamic Republic. The fact that Washington has failed to bend the indomitable will of Tehran over the past four decades, in spite of intensity of its plots, is a firm testimony to the resolve of the Iranians to thwart hegemony, as well as a proof that the United States is on the decline. If the scoundrel Donald Trump of the Republican regime had axed the U.S. feet while in power at the White House for 4 years, it is now crystal clear that the present Democrat regime headed by Joe Biden and his bled vision of realities is sawing the branch on which Uncle Sam has chosen to sit. He is pursuing the same self-destructive policies of his predecessor. Regarding Iran, its steadily growing scientific technological progress and the will of West Asia's awakened masses who, in opposition to the ruthless ruling regimes and their treason against Islam and Muslims, are fully determined to rid the region of not only the unwanted military presence of the Americans, but the illegal existence in Palestine of the racist terrorist entity called Israel. This explains the frenzied efforts of the U.S. and some of its clients in the Persian Gulf to grant a sort of legitimacy to the illegal Zionist entity throughout diplomatic ties and military and security cooperation. It is obvious they will not succeed in their nefarious designs, as is evident by their debacle in Yemen, before that in Syria and Iraq, and Iran has cautioned these regimes of their folly of dalliance with Israel, along with subservience to the U.S., which will only accelerate their own downfall. It was the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran these days in 1979 that changed the political equations of the Muslim Ummah, if not the entire world. Today, the malign behavior of the U.S. is firmly countered by the people of West Asia and throughout the world, as is evident in Latin America and other places. American provocations against Russia and China, respectively in Ukraine and Taiwan, are bound to backfire with disastrous consequences for the U.S. regime and its comrades in crimes against world people.
www.parstoday.com/en.